Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, homeschooling is on the rise. We'll meet one Valley mom who opted to teach her kids at home.
And the argument for the federal government taking a more active role in Colorado River negotiations.
But first, Governor Katie Hobbs presented her fourth State of the State address to a joint session of the state legislature yesterday. And she honed in on tax breaks for the middle class, Arizonans, and affordability.
Affordability is my top priority, and I'm encouraged that it's yours as well. And now is the time to back up that talk. Put the middle class tax cut package on my desk immediately. I'll sign it.
The governor also went after data centers and their use of much-needed water in our state and short-term rentals like Airbnbs, suggesting a new rental fee. Now it's time for state lawmakers to have their say as the new session gets underway at the state capitol this week. And KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke is on the line now from the capitol to tell us more. Good morning there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so affordability we know is likely to be like the Democrats' big message across the nation, right, coming up on the midterm elections this year. Governor Hobbs seems to be in lockstep there.
Yeah, a lot of her speech and a lot of her agenda for this upcoming session focuses on affordability. Nothing super groundbreaking, but kind of like looking for money to expand existing programs, expand eligibility for existing programs that help people afford utilities and weatherizing their homes, things that can kind of lower those electricity bills, and looking for ways to stoke more affordable housing, that kind of thing.
Okay. So let's talk about her proposed tax cuts here. She says she wants to conform to some of the tax cuts included in the big, beautiful bill, but legislative Republicans, it sounds like, want all of them, more of them?
Yeah, this is a fight we kind of got previewed a little while back when the governor first came out and backed this tax cut package. Essentially, she wants the state to adopt some of the federal level cuts from the, you know, Trump's big, beautiful bill that would, she, in her view, the ones that would most benefit the middle class. We're talking things like no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, increasing the standard deduction. But as you mentioned, Republicans kind of want to fully conform essentially with the Trump tax cuts, a much bigger plan. Hobbs says, those additional cuts would disproportionately benefit corporations. Republicans say that's not true, that they think their package is what's best for Arizonans.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll hear more about that in a minute. I'm going to have a conversation with the Speaker of the House, Steve Montenegro, coming up, and he talks about that. Let's talk, Wayne, about some of the other proposals the governor included in this big speech yesterday. She focused in on data centers as well, which is kind of a big talking point right now, very controversial in a lot of places in the state. She wants to get rid of a tax incentive that's been around for a long time here.
Yeah, this is a tax incentive. It's about a decade old, a little older than that. Back then, it was pitched as a way to bring this industry to Arizona, this growing, important industry. Now this industry is here. You know, some metrics, some commercial real estate firms say that Phoenix or the Maricopa County generally has kind of the second most robust market in the world for data centers now. So I think Hobbs and some others are saying that means we don't need this tax credit. Mm-hmm. They don't need incentive to come here anymore. So we'll see. We'll see how that fares. I talked with one Republican, Senator T.J. Shope, who's not on board with that. But I don't know if that is a sentiment that's shared by all of his colleagues. We've heard this idea of getting rid of that tax break floating around a bit.
Mm. Governor Hobbs also addressed housing, Wayne. She suggested a way to kind of incentivize developers to build low-income housing. What might that look like?
Yeah, without getting too into the financial weeds, it's essentially creating a mechanism to use a pot of public dollars along with private investment to create this bonding program, and it would allow developers to get a lower interest rate. So, you know, not exactly the same as going out and purchasing your home, but, you know, broadly speaking, lower interest rates, you know, make it easier, more affordable to build this kind of thing. And so, as the governor said, basically it is a way to stoke that building by giving developers this new mechanism to get those lower rates.
Yeah, and affordable housing has been such an important issue here. What about what she said about Airbnb, short-term rentals, things like that? She wants to impose a new fee there?
Yeah, and it wasn't so much directed at, like, it wasn't like an attack on short-term rental. It was just, I guess this was a place where she thought there might be, you could throw this $3.50 fee in and and she's, you know, she characterized it less than a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. And that would go into a fund of money that's going to pay for some of those programs I mentioned earlier. So expanding eligibility for that, like utility and bill assistance program, for instance. It's paid for by federal money, but she wants to increase the amount of people who qualify for that. And to do that, it would provide some ongoing money if this fee were adopted by the state.
Yeah. Okay. Looking for places to find the money. Wayne, let me ask you about how likely it might be that the governor will be able to enact any of this agenda, get it passed. We have a GOP-run legislature in both chambers and a Democratic governor. What's this? What's going to happen in terms of negotiations here?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, the response wasn't great from Republicans. We mentioned the tax cuts. They're obviously on different pages there. The Republicans plan to send her their tax cut package this week, like get it to her almost immediately.
Right.
So, and then I know Republicans were not happy with that Airbnb fee. You know, they essentially view it as a new tax. So a lot of those items, you know, once we get into budget season and there's negotiations, you could see maybe something slipped in, but the response wasn't great. The one caveat is Colorado River negotiations. The governor wants to beef up the fund for that and to help the state prepare for Colorado River water cuts using a fee on data center water usage.
Mm-hmm.
That is something potentially that they could I could see having some bipartisan support because the governor and Republicans have been broadly in line on trying to prepare Arizona for these cuts and ensure that Arizona gets a fair shake in these negotiations.
Right, right. Okay, so before I let you go, Wayne, last minute here or so, it's the start of a new and exciting legislative session. I'm sure you are caffeinated, rearing to go. Lots of bills
yep.
have already been filed. Anything interesting you're watching for here?
Yeah, I think some of the interesting stuff is what we're seeing on housing. It looks like we're maybe seeing a push away from like the last few sessions. Lawmakers have looked at like deregulating zoning at the local level to boost mm-hmm. housing. Now we're seeing some other ideas, something to use vacant space on school district property to create affordable housing for teachers and things like that. We're seeing more regulation of Airbnbs potentially going through with maybe some bipartisan support in terms of like limiting the number that could be in a city or giving cities more power to control the Airbnbs there. And something I know you talked about recently, limiting investor ownership, out-of-state investor ownership of homes is yeah. another thing that looks like it could have some bipartisan support. Democrats have loved it for a long time. And now it looks like with President Trump backing a similar idea, Republicans could potentially get on board as well.
Ah, very interesting. All right. We will leave it there for now. Lots to watch for. I'm sure we'll be hearing from Wayne a lot. That is KJZZ's own Wayne Shetsky from our politics desk joining us from the state capitol. Wayne, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And now let's turn to my conversation with Speaker of the House, Steve Montenegro. I got him on the line earlier this morning to talk about the governor's speech, what he makes of some of her proposals, and the GOP's priorities for the upcoming session. We began with tax cuts and where he and the governor disagree.
Well, look, we've been working on making sure that we get every benefit possible on this conformity, on the big, beautiful bill for Arizonans. But here's where the disagreement is. Last session, we sent up many bills that would give money back to Arizonans, that would cut taxes, lower the tax burden, and bring relief to Arizonans. She vetoed all of them. And over the last 3 years, we've been sending bills that would also cut government spending, both of these approaches. The Big Beautiful Bill actually placed all of those bills, all of those measures that we had, and it enacted them into law. And so now at the state level, we have the opportunity to do both. Where the difference is that the governor doesn't want to do it fully.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Arizonans deserve someone and deserve their representatives to fight for as much relief as they can get possible. And so I think that's where the bigger difference is.
Right. So the governor says here that adopting all of those tax cuts from the Big Beautiful Bill will benefit the wealthiest Arizonans. You kind of say the same thing about the tax cuts she wants to implement. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you take a look at the bill we just introduced, if you take a look at that, you'll see that we removed some of those tax cuts that would not benefit middle class or everyday Arizonans. To focus on affordability, to focus on the cost of living. So we are actually excited we have a game plan. We have that bill ready to go. You'll see fast action this week in it. And hopefully she agrees to sign it. It's exactly what we've been talking about.
So a lot of this is going to come down to what gets cut in terms of spending, right? Like if you and the governor want to implement tax cuts, that means less spending on state programs, safety net programs included. How do you plan to pay for your tax cut package? Like, what will get cut?
Well, number one, we here in Arizona, we pass responsible budgets. The Constitution of Arizona says we have to have a balanced budget every year. So the hyperinflation that we're seeing and the hit that everyday Arizonans are feeling is because of that overspending. And I call it dramatic overspending that the Biden administration did over the last 4 years. So here in Arizona, what we want to continue to do is we want to make sure we continue to avoid that disaster. We have steady revenues coming in. They could be better. But this year has to be a little bit lean. And I'll give you an example. Over the last 5 years, if you look at where the budget was 5 years ago to today, our revenues in the state have increased by $3.5 billion. We believe that some of that should go back to the citizens of Arizona.
Right. But where will these cuts come from? Especially, as you say, we're looking at a pretty lean year. We know we're facing a pretty significant budget deficit, and the cause of that is up for debate, whether it's, you know, the income tax program that was put into place or whether it's other factors. We're kind of looking at a softening economy, a softening job market. What's going to get cut? Are you targeting or looking at specific programs?
Well, like, for example, if you take a look at some of the waste that's in the process, we have to take a look at all government programs. Where the waste, where the fraud is, where the abuse. I'll give an example. In access, since 2020, it's gone up by $10 billion, the spending there. Mm-hmm. In our Medicaid.
This is Arizona's programs. Medicaid program. Yeah.
Arizona alone. It went from $13 billion in 2020 to $23 billion today. And so we have to make sure that the spending is actually going to people that need it. We want to make sure that it's actually reaching folks. We have the vulnerable population. We have our elderly. We have children with needs. We want to make sure that it's going there. But if you're an able-bodied citizen, we have to make sure that we have policies that get you back to work so you can be the one that's producing for our society. Go ahead.
Yeah. So are you looking at cuts to Medicaid to access here?
No. What we're looking at is where there is fraud, where there's waste, where there's abuse in the system.
Let me ask you about something else, Speaker. The governor proposed getting rid of a tax incentive for data centers. Data centers have become kind of a hot topic, a controversial point here in the state. Our data center industry is really massive, and some metrics even show it's like the second most robust data center market in the world. But they use a whole lot of water at a time when we do not have it, and people are starting to notice that and protest these new data centers when they come in. The governor also proposed a new fee on data centers to aid Colorado River cuts that are, you know, pretty likely coming here. I wonder what you make of that proposal. Is that something you might be able to support?
Well, we have to look at what proposals actually get introduced. I'll tell you that a lot of the technologies that are coming in from these data centers don't use water. They use their own their own systems of technology to produce energy. So the details, we have to take a look at it as well. But we also have to look at what is causing or bringing economic growth to the state, what's bringing jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we have to balance out, because we can't just target certain industries or certain sectors. And that ends up hurting the economy. That ends up hurting jobs. And so we have to be very mindful of that.
Sounds like not something you're immediately on board with.
I want to make sure we're looking at the actual proposals introduced before we have those conversations.
Okay. Let me ask you about Prop 123, which needs to be extended and sent back to voters. It funds education via the state land trust. There's talk that some Republican lawmakers might want to include a provision in it that would enshrine the ESA, the school voucher program, in the state constitution as part of that extension. Would you support something like that?
Well, look, when I talk about 123, we have to remember that it was a Republican-led effort that was designed to address a specific challenge, financial challenge, when it was implemented. And it maintained a conservative framework so that we can keep taxes low. I think that any measure that we're going to be looking at that should maintain that same spirit. I'll tell you also that what it's turning into, what we have to be careful is that we don't use, or that it doesn't turn, 123 doesn't turn into some election year theatrics. Mm-hmm. Because the truth of the matter is that last year, we ended up backfilling the $300 million that went to education. We ended up backfilling it from the general Fine. So that was taken care of. And we're going to do the same this year.
Okay.
Education is going to be taken care of. The other thing that's really important when we have the 1-2-3 discussion is today, this administration, any administration, can actually increase dollars for education today. All they have to do is start selling more public lands. And that's something that they're not doing. So if we're going to do any measure that has to do with 1-2-3, we have to be good stewards of the people's lands. And we have to be effective as to what we're doing, not just try and play election year theatrics.
Do you anticipate the ESA program being a part of that conversation, though?
We are having those conversations absolutely as a whole.
Okay. Let me ask you lastly, Speaker, where do you anticipate or do you anticipate any areas in which you might be able to find common ground with the governor or Democrats in the upcoming session? As you mentioned, the governor has vetoed a whole lot of proposals that have come from your side of the aisle. Are there places where you think you might be able to work together?
Of course, there's always room. And I'll tell you, one of the areas that we're united is we're going to continue to fight, at least Republicans on our end, and we've heard similar from the governor. We're going to continue to fight for Arizona's water. You know, they're the interests of Arizona, whether it's rural, whether it's growth, we want to make sure that Arizona has its fair share. Arizona's been a great steward of water. And so it's time for the Upper Basin to do their part. We're going to stand strong to make sure Arizona's its benefits are looking after.
Okay. That is Speaker of the House, Steve Montenegro, joining us. Mr. Speaker, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, can Arizona really have one of the best beaches in the country?
But first, the Federal Bureau of Reclamation late last week released a draft environmental impact statement outlining options for how to deal with the Colorado River going forward. Rules governing the river are set to expire, and the seven basin states haven't been able to agree on a new plan for the overallocated river. My next guest argues the feds should be getting more involved. Michael Cohen is a senior fellow with the Pacific Institute and has been working on the Colorado River for nearly 30 years. He argues the states have had enough time to come up with a solution on their own, and since they haven't, the federal government needs to come in with a plan for the states and other stakeholders. I spoke with him shortly before the Bureau of Reclamation released its EIS about why he thinks this is the best approach at this point.
So there's been a number of challenges with the Colorado River negotiations, and over the years, even since the mid-90s when the Secretary of the Interior, then Bruce Babbitt, came in to tell California to reduce its use, it was this credible federal threat, this idea that the federal government was going to take some action and impose some kind of rule or a change on the system that got the Colorado River Basin states to act. And in recent years, what we've seen instead of a credible federal threat is this idea that the federal government was here to facilitate, not dictate. And given how long it's taken the Colorado River Basin states to come to an agreement, my argument is that it hasn't worked and we need a change.
So do you think then that the federal government just kind of has to tick all the states off in some way? Like, is that kind of the answer here? Because it just seems kind of unlikely that the feds would come in and say, okay, here's the plan, and all seven states are going to say, oh yeah, why didn't we come up with that?
Part of my reasoning is that there needs to be a credible threat so that the seven basin states have the room to operate. Because we're in a situation now where the amount of water flowing down the Colorado River continues to decline pretty markedly. As the climate gets hotter and drier, there's simply less water available for everyone. But it's very difficult for any negotiator, for any of the basin states, to step up and basically say, we're going to sacrifice ourselves for the good of the whole. Whereas if they're responding to a federal threat, then they have some political cover, and then it gives each of these basin states the ability to step up and say that if we don't do something now, it's going to be worse otherwise.
So in your perfect world, then, would the federal plan that they threaten be an actual workable plan, or like worst case scenario that would sort of spur the states into doing what they maybe would not have been able to do otherwise?
Well, we're pretty far from a perfect world these days, but my hope is that what I outlined was a credible plan, or at least a plan that would have multiple benefits for the system, for the environment, and would lay out some realistic alternatives, but that really, to be realistic, such a plan won't be implemented, but would provide enough, maybe even fear is the right word, for the basin states that they would come together and come up with their own plan.
Okay, so let's talk about the plan that you have outlined for the states. And it's very detailed, and we obviously can't get into all of it, but it seems as though what you're calling for from the federal government's perspective is that both the upper basin and lower basin need to take some cuts here.
Yeah, so part of the challenge, I think, is that many of the basin states, and particularly in my home state of Colorado and other states in the upper basin, are working off the wrong framing. Many people see this as a zero-sum game. And even there's been threats of litigation, then with litigation, of course, there's winners and losers. But I think what's really happening with the river is that, as I've said, the river is shrinking. There's simply less for everyone. So we're dealing with a shrinking pie rather than a zero-sum game. And with a shrinking pie, again, there's going to have to be cuts in the lower basin and the upper basin. The lower basin's already taking quite a bit of cuts. The upper basin quite correctly claims that if there's not water in the streams, they can't divert it and use it. So as the years get drier and drier, there's less water to divert. But in some ways, upper basin use has been creeping upwards a little bit in recent years. So there's a lot of opportunity, certainly in the upper basin, to get back to where they were a few years ago and to demonstrate that there's a lot of pain in both basins, but everybody really needs to step up and take these cuts, both in the upper basin and the lower basin.
Is it your sense of it that that is one of the, if not the biggest sticking points here? Because when you listen to the rhetoric coming from negotiators, from some of the politicians involved, both between the upper and lower basins, and like it seems as though one or both's willingness to take some cuts and the severity of those cuts really seems to be sort of at the heart of all of this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the rhetoric has become increasingly polarizing of late. And that leaves, I think, less space for any of the negotiators to come to a compromise. So, again, this hope that there's this big federal hammer out there will give them that space to compromise.
How optimistic are you that if the feds came in with a plan, be it a plan like the one you're proposing or something else, that that would actually, in a sense, kind of scare the states into coming up with their own compromise?
I would say my optimism about events these days is pretty limited, but there's more and more pressure on the basin states. I think most people understand that litigation is a worse outcome because it creates even greater uncertainty. And then even when somebody wins in court, even at the Supreme Court, as we saw with Arizona back in the 60s, it then goes to Congress, and Congress can change it. And what the Congress is going to do, particularly this Congress, is anybody's guess. So there's just so much uncertainty with leaving it to other actors to come up with a solution that I think it's far better for the seven basin states to come up with something. And I'm hopeful that that'll happen, but they haven't done it yet.
Right. Well, I guess I wonder then if there's maybe a danger that what the federal government proposes, as you've described it, sort of a hammer, might actually end up becoming the plan if the states can't come up with something on their own.
That's certainly a fallback option, and what exactly that looks like is uncertain.
If the states were to agree to a compromise kind of along the lines of what you are proposing, would that do it? Like, would that solve the problem, at least for now?
Well, what we've seen repeatedly in the Colorado River is once the seven basin states come to an agreement, that's the agreement. So the hope is certainly that if they can come to an agreement, it'll provide some surety, some reliability for the system moving forward. But how long that's going to last, I think, is another point of contention, because given how quickly the system's changing, there's some calls for a kind of a short-term agreement, a 3 to 5 year agreement, so they can come up either with something longer term or just to see how the system's going to react.
It seems as though there are sort of dangers in different approaches, right? Like if you do what you just suggested, sort of a short-term solution, in air quotes solution, like the danger there, it seems to me, would be that it was like pulling teeth to get them to come up with this. So in you have to do this again in 3 years. Like what's that going to look like? But if they come up with a longer term plan, it seems as though without some kind of flexibility built into it, the danger there might be there's a situation where you're sort of locked in to this plan that deals with a certain amount of water that maybe doesn't actually exist anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what happened with the existing guidelines, the 2007 shortage guidelines, is that it wasn't enough. And we saw 4 years ago, the system was really crashing, and they had to revisit the rules to come up with these short-term tweaks. So my expectation is any agreement that they come up with will have some language in there saying, if conditions get so bad, they'll have to revisit it.
All right. That is Michael Cohen, a senior fellow with the Pacific Institute. Michael, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you reaching out. Thanks much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Homeschooling is gaining traction in Arizona. With the rise of school choice, a global pandemic, the closed schools temporarily, and the availability of state-funded school vouchers for any kid in the state, it's becoming more mainstream. In fact, homeschooling increased at a rate of more than 5% across the country last year, according to research from Johns Hopkins. And that's nearly three times the pre-pandemic rate of around 2%. Brooke Bentley is a real estate agent and mom of four in Queen Creek, and she started homeschooling her kids 4 years ago. She also founded what she says is one of the few secular homeschool enrichment programs in the area called PATH, or Progressive Academic Thoughtful Homeschool Collective. Many programs like that are religious and decidedly not progressive. So Bentley isn't like a lot of homeschooling moms out there for that reason. And she's also not anti-public education. In fact, her youngest daughter is still in kindergarten in a public school. In fact, all of her kids started in public schools. But one by one, she pulled them out, she says, because she found it's not one size fits all. For her oldest son, it was about catching him up after a bad third grade year. And for her second, it was about tailoring a curriculum to his needs. They found out that he was severely dyslexic a few years ago, and Bentley wasn't sure about the school's solution.
Cole was pulled out of general education and put into a special education classroom with eight nonverbal kids. And I know they wanted to give him more one-on-one and help him learn to read because he was not thriving in that gen ed classroom. But by the end of the year, he still didn't know his alphabet and was, I think, hindered socially being in a classroom with nonverbal children. So I knew that that was not a good fit.
I spoke with her more about her decision to homeschool, her thoughts on the politics surrounding ESAs in Arizona and how it all works. See, once you decide to homeschool a kid, you can buy a curriculum to follow, and there are a host of different kinds with varying perspectives. She told me teaching three kids, different kids at three different grade levels involves a whole lot of prep.
Three different grades and all the subject within that grade. So, you know, you have your writing and your reading and your math and your science and your history and cursive and all the things, right, that kids learn. And you're handling all the subjects for all of these children. It's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of prep time. It's a lot of research into curriculum. You know, what's rigorous? What's going to fit my child and their learning style? It's a ton of work.
Yeah. Okay. And beyond that, you're also a real estate agent and you like have a job. And then you're also running on Fridays a collective of sorts, like a micro school for other homeschooled kids, right?
Right. So it's a homeschool enrichment program. And this is our second year. So we've grown tremendously this year. We started last year. We had 27 kids.
Okay.
And three teachers, essentially, including myself. And this year, I'm not teaching. I'm just running it with the other founder. And we have almost 25 teachers and 103 students. So
wow.
It's exploded this year, which is a testament to how much, you know, these types of programs are needed in the homeschool community.
Right, right. And homeschooling has, in general, exploded as well. Talk a little bit about why you think that is. Like, why do you think more kids are finding your program in particular, but also just more families are opting for homeschooling?
Because education is just not one size fits all. So if you have a child that's not thriving in public school, charter school, private school, in the traditional classroom, it's very tempting when you see homeschoolers who can cater their education to their child's needs.
Hmm.
And so especially with the ESA funding being universal as of a few years ago, it used to be just for children with disabilities. Now anybody can receive those funds if they homeschool. And so that opens a ton of opportunities for families who otherwise wouldn't be able to homeschool.
Right.
I think it's exploded in that reason as well.
Yeah.
At PATH, a good chunk of them are homeschooling because they have a neurodivergent child.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not the case, a lot of them are homeschooling because they want the family time. They want more time with their kids. You know, we send our kids to public school and they come home and they do their extracurriculars and it's dinner and bedtime. And I think parents are just kind of feeling like they're missing out on a large chunk of their kids' childhood and then always more individualized learning.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, because it's a form of trying to socialize your kids who are at home instead of in a classroom full of kids every day. I think one of the kind of traditional critiques or like suspicions about homeschooling, right, is that these kids are isolated. Like, how do they learn to get along with other kids? Is this the answer?
Yes. I mean, that's the most common question I get as a homeschooling parent.
I'm sure.
Is, yeah. You know, even my neighbor, he's a good friend, but I had to laugh when I told him we were going to homeschool and he's like, well, aren't you worried about your kid being weird? I'm like, I think I would have asked the same thing at one point, but really, it is the most common question. But honestly, being socialized just means learning to live in a community. It doesn't require a classroom. It requires people.
Hmm.
And I think homeschoolers, they do have to be intentional, you know, about creating those opportunities for their kids. But on the other hand, I feel like my kids are exposed to a more diverse population of people.
Hmm.
And I think having the Friday school as well has been really helpful, because our micro school provides up an opportunity to see the same kids every week and really deepen those relationships.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the kind of politics surrounding this, not just of the ESA program we'll get to in a moment, but it sounds like you, unlike a lot of homeschooling families, pulled your kids out of school because you thought it was too conservative, maybe even too religious.
Yeah, in some ways, yes. Especially, you know, in the neighborhood I'm in, a lot of conservative families, a lot of religious families, and that's great. That's, you know, not how our family operates. And so I noticed, looking into how to teach my oldest history, that it was not taught to me in a transparent way at all. You know, I look back in my education, I'm like, I never learned about a lot of these things. You know, why were these people's stories left out? And not highlighted. So I started recognizing that I wanted to teach my kids a more transparent history and really highlight a lot of the voices that I think traditionally aren't. Women, people of color, LGBTQ community, those kind of stories that really weren't included in the history textbooks when I was a kid and a lot of times aren't now.
What are your thoughts on public education? Like, it sounds like you are not super critical of it in general, but just thought maybe there's a better way. I mean, do you think that public education is doing what it should be doing in our state?
You know, I think it's essential. I think for a lot of families, it's critical. I think it's just not one size fits all, especially for kids with learning disabilities or any kind of diagnosis. It's really difficult in a classroom setting, especially with 29 other children, to receive individualized education.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some kids it works, but for my son with dyslexia, it just wasn't a fit. Mm. You know, so having the opportunity to homeschool is a privilege. You know, I'm grateful we live in a place where I can do that and I can cater their education to exactly where they're at, not just between children, but between subjects.
So tell us how this has worked, not just for your daughter or your older son, but for your son with dyslexia in particular. Like, you're having to learn a lot about, I'm sure, how to teach a curriculum like that to a kid with challenges like that. But I mean, is he doing well? How's it working?
Yeah, I mean, it's been such a journey even for me, because there's no how-to guide or manual. It's no joke. I mean, it's really a challenge, and he has severe dyslexia. And so we have tried a lot of different programs and finally, you know, settled on one that he seems to be making progress now, and he's slowly starting to read. He's in fifth grade now. And so as you can imagine, being a fifth grader not reading fluently is a huge hit to your confidence when you're with your peers. And so we're working really hard to try and get him reading fluently. And part of that is having that ESA funding allows us to hire a tutor who is certified in this program.
Yeah. So let's talk about the ESA funds, right? Because they are controversial in the state. We're the first state in the country that made them universal so that everyone could access them kind of no matter what for any reason like this educationally. And it sounds like you've really benefited from that. You think that's part of the reason homeschooling is kind of booming right now. But there's lots of critiques about abuses of that program, like parents buying, you know, giant Lego sets, trips to ski resorts, things that raise a lot of eyebrows when you're looking at spending public funds. What are your views on that and how the program is being implemented in the state?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there are things that slip through the cracks or, you know, silly things are bought. But in my experience, I mean, every single thing I've bought has to be backed up by curriculum. For example, if I want to buy a box of pencils, mm-hmm. I have to have a curriculum that shows it requires pencils. So it's not just willy-nilly. I'm sure there are people who abuse the system like any system. But for the most part, it's pretty well run. And a curriculum is required for any supplemental material that you want. So I do a lot. I spend a lot of time just even there uploading curriculum and like all the things that I buy, I have to show documentation for.
Right. So from your point of view, it's very kind of tightened up. A lot of the debate around this at the state legislature is putting on safeguards, checks to make sure that people are following the rules like you are. Do you think that would be a good thing?
I absolutely do. Mm-hmm. I really do. I mean, I have no problems with that at all. I think that we should be spending that money responsibly as homeschool parents. And so I'm willing to jump through those hoops to show documentation and show curriculum for the things I buy if that's necessary and it prevents abuse of the system. I'm for it.
Okay. Well, thank you for giving us a peek inside your world of homeschooling. That is Brooke Bentley. She is a real estate agent, a mom of four who homeschools, and a founder of Path Collective. Brooke, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Good morning. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Big change and rapid growth are nothing new in Lake Havasu City. Situated on the western edge of the state along the Colorado River, Lake Havasu City was founded in the early 1960s and quickly built a reputation in Arizona as a beautiful place to go boating and hiking. But it was in 1971, when the town purchased the old London Bridge and relocated it to Lake Havasu, that people around the country and the world began to take notice.
In 1964, only 5 people lived here. Today, 14,000. Tomorrow, who knows? The hot desert air and bountiful lakeside advantages are drawing people in record numbers. At least 50 new single-family homes are being built here each month.
That's a clip from a CBS News broadcast in 1978. The population of Lake Havasu City has grown to about 60,000 since then. And thanks to a recent round of publicity, more may be coming. Last November, the LA Times wrote about the surge of Californians relocating to the town. In December, Condé Nast Traveler listed Lake Havasu State Park among the 15 best beaches in the U.S. To get a sense of how the town is adapting to all of this, our co-host Sam Dingman recently spoke with the mayor of Lake Havasu City, Cal Sheehy. He acknowledged that while it's a bit of a coup, his word, for a landlocked state to make the Condé Nast list, he's not surprised. Sheehy has lived in Lake Havasu City since he was a teenager and says new residents are discovering what he's known for a long time.
There's white sandy beaches that adore the Bridgewater Channel, overlooking beautiful landscape of mountains and the lake. It's also where the river and Lake Havasu converge. So it's a really great ecosystem, as well as next to wildlife refuge area. So it has great natural wildlife. It has great recreation, a great opportunity for people to get on a paddleboard or a kayak, or if they want to jump on a jet ski or a powerboat, or even go out fishing. There's just so many opportunities to do so many things from the shoreline and from the beaches at Lake Havasu State Park.
You moved, if I'm not mistaken, to Lake Havasu from Michigan, right?
Yes, I did.
What were your impressions when you first arrived? You were a sophomore in high school, right?
Yes, yeah, so we drove across country from Michigan and, you know, it took several days. And as we were making our final drive into Lake Havasu, if you're coming in from the northern part of the community, it's up on a bluff. And as you're coming along Highway 95, it opens and expands to the beautiful landscape of the Colorado River, Lake Havasu, and the mountains in the background. Mm-hmm. And it's really just breathtaking when you first see it. It still takes my breath away each day that I come back from somewhere in the northern part of the state or the county and be able to see that view of Lake Havasu. And that was the first view that welcomed us when my family moved here.
Yeah. Did you have any inkling at that time that you wanted to run for elected office, say, or that Arizona would be the place where you would make your home as an adult?
You know, at that time, no. It was I was born and raised in Michigan until I was 15 years old, and obviously moved out here when I was 15. And so I didn't really know anything different. And so, you know, I just experienced it all and took it all in. And I was fortunate enough to start working at a local resort in Lake Havasu at that time and found my passion very quickly of service and service from the heart, which, you know, is a great segue and pathway into elected office at the local level. And those that serve it with heart are most effective, in my opinion.
Boy, that's very interesting to go right into a service position like that at a resort, because at a moment when you have just moved to a place, you're instantly putting yourself in a position to kind of be an ambassador for the place.
Very true. Yes. And I was very proud to be able to create memories for our residents that use the resort for different aspects, whether it be a wedding or a birthday party, a baby shower, whatever else that special is happening in their world, that we could be a part of it, was really great work and meaningful work. And I still enjoy it to this day.
Yeah. Can I ask, I mean, was there anything from that time where you realized, like, oh, this is a specifically Lake Havasu moment that I'm having right now, unlike the ones I would have had back home in Michigan?
You know, it's, you'd be surprised still to this day, but even all those years ago when I first started, the number of people that come from the UK that have experienced the story of the London Bridge back in its original home,
right, of course,
and are coming back to discover it here in its new home in America, is a sense of wonderment and awe as they walk across the bridge. Our visitor center, which is located in the English Village just adjacent to the London Bridge, gives a certificate to those that have crossed both the London Bridge in the UK
That's great.
The London Bridge here in Lake Havasu City.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm curious to know what you make of this. I mean, since I have moved here, I've been here for about 2 years at this point, and something that comes up very frequently in the conversations I have with fellow relative newcomers is that Arizona in general, and I would imagine maybe Lake Havasu in particular, given its really natural beauty, is a place where people come to make a fresh start, to kind of rediscover themselves, maybe to see themselves in a different way.
No, it truly is in the fabric of what Lake Havasu City is and what it becomes. One unique thing about Lake Havasu City is that everybody that lives here has chosen to live here. And so we're just now starting to have, you know, first generation born residents that are occurring here. But we're a fairly young community. Well, we were incorporated in 1978, founded in the late 1960s by Mr. Robert McCulloch, who is the founder of our city and master planned it with his friend C.V. Wood, who was the planner of Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And we're able to create this desert oasis in the middle of nowhere, Arizona. And those residents that are pioneers of our community came and they rolled up their sleeves and they helped build this community one store at a time, one school at a time, you know, one business at a time, and one family at a time. And because of that, we still attract people that are looking for a new start.
So am I hearing you right that you feel like there's a sense of a kind of participatory sense in making a new culture kind of out of almost nothing?
Yeah, very true. That is exactly what happens every single day in Lake Havasu. The things that occur here are passion projects of citizens, and other citizens join on to support those causes, whether it's, you know, fitness stations in one of our parks, or if it's wayfinding signage along one of the hiking trails, whatever that might be. It's a passion project of a citizen who then engages other citizens to get something done. And you'll see that replicated throughout our community over and over again.
Have there been any growing pains in that process? Any things you're hoping you can do differently or improve in the coming years, now that hopefully, you know, through this Condé Nast article, there will be this influx of new visitors?
You know, we have experienced some growing pains, especially over the last 5 years. You know, traffic is a little bit more congested at a stoplight, which might mean that you have to wait 30 seconds longer than you did before. So still the small town feel, but just with a little bit more folks around.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. You know, the idea of like experiencing traffic kind of for the first time and having to remind yourself in the moment, like, okay, well, this is a byproduct of the fact that we're building this place that a lot of people want to move to and live. So it's not inherently a bad thing.
Very true. But it is change, and change is very difficult for people.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to those types of change, we want to be very sensitive to the needs of our residents, as well as the future of what our community is going to be.
I have to ask, I'm sure you know that Lake Havasu has had a reputation as a spring break destination. How have you had to confront that over the years? And what do you make of that perception?
Sure. Yeah, it's unfortunate that we have that perception because we are such an amazing destination for so many visitors over the 52 weeks in a year. And everyone focuses on 3 weeks a year in the spring that we welcome college age students to experience our beautiful area. So we're a whole lot more than just a party destination or spring break destination. We're boating events and we have regattas and fishing tournaments and triathlons and all of the things that really make a destination vibrant and exciting. And we're a whole lot more than just that image of the spring break crowd in the month of March. And those folks that come in March, believe it or not, have and make really fantastic memories where they relocate with their families when they're done with school. So they finish sure. school and they want to come back to Lake Havasu and they lay down roots.
That's a nice way of thinking about it, that it can be a gateway to spending more time there. I have been speaking with the mayor of Lake Havasu City, Cal Sheehy. Mr. Mayor, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Let the record show that Lauren is dancing to Miley Cyrus.
One of my favorite songs.
All right.
Well, my kid's favorite song.
Thank you for clarifying. All right. That'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along and bopping along with us. Don't forget, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter called Radioheads at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.